Welcome, everybody, to Radio Free Nintendo, an outrageously benign Nintendo podcast for grown-ups. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. And with me tonight, John Lindemann.
Howdy, y'all.
That's benign, by the way.
John, do you have a hip-hop intro? That was requested on our Facebook page.
Please don't.
I could think something up. Hey, yo, yo.
Please don't.
My name is John. I'm the podcast Don Juan. I transform like a Decepticon. There you go.
That is fucking terrible.
Off the top.
Off the dome. Off the dome, Johnny. Off the dome.
That's like jazz.
That is the worst.
It's there. It's not there, and then it's there, and then it's gone.
That is the worst thing ever recorded. Ever.
Do you think it would make John look better or worse for me to use the editing to make it seem like that was more or less spontaneous?
I think
it was
make...
spontaneous.
It was spontaneous. I mean, you can't get more spontaneous than that.
Unprompted. Unprompted is the word he's looking for.
Are you kidding? The streets are on fire because of that verse. On fire.
Yes, in riots. They are burning things because they are so upset.
And righteously indignant about this whole damn thing, James Jones.
I wouldn't call that indignant. I would call that shame.
I would call it play a hating.
Yep. Hate is gonna hate.
Mm-hmm.
Also with us from Mary UK is Greg Lay.
Ahoy, ahoy.
All right. This is the part of the show where we talk about games that we have been playing in the past week. John has two, so I put him first. Because this is a special occasion.
Well, I don't know. They may count as one because they're both shooters. But I'm going to talk about a Soldner X2 Final Prototype, which is a shoot-em-up on PSN.
Is this like a new shoot-em-up, or is this like a re-release of an old one?
No, this is a new one.
This is the final one. Apparently,
the final prototype.
Final prototype, maybe, before they start mass production.
Yeah, maybe after this, the next game will be the real deal, I guess.
John just paid for the second beta edition, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel kind of screwed, but... Yeah, it's by East Asia Soft, which, you know, is likely...
East Asia Soft!
Yeah.
Specific.
Yeah, I don't even... I don't know, but yeah, it's... Because I downloaded the first game, Soldner X, of course. And yeah, this, you know, it's a side-scrolling shoot-em-up. Looks like something off of the Amiga, kind of. Has that kind of vibe, kind of sort of a European vibe. It's not really, you know, anime-inspired or anything.
So does it have, like, modern graphics, though? I mean, it's PlayStation 3, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's all HD. But, I mean, you know, they look kind of hand-painted, sort of. I don't know, it's... it's kind of hard to describe, because it really has kind of an art style that's... You don't really see. I mean, usually... Things are either they look very arcadey or they're like, you know, anime inspired or something, and it lies kind of somewhere in between, I guess. But yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about it, I mean, of course, you know, it's a side-scrolling shoot 'em up, so you pretty much know what to expect, large bosses, and, you know, you have a bunch of power-ups that you can go through kind of thing. Some cool things about it are the way that you can cycle through your guns for your ship. You can pretty much do it on the fly. You have three different guns that you can just cycle through at any one time. Of course, you have, like, your super bombs. The cool thing that they do, though, that I thought was kind of notable was the way that they handle unlocking levels. The first time I played it, I only had to continue once. I think there's probably about 6 or 7 levels. I played through the entire thing pretty much the first time I sat down. And I played through it on normal. And, I mean, usually, I mean, I'm used to playing shooters where you just get your ass handed to you in the second level. Maybe you'll beat the first boss. And they, you know, they require a whole lot of time spent to actually master each level. This one, Soldner X2, it's not like that at all. And kind of what they do is they let you go through these first 6 or 7 levels, and they aren't really too difficult. And then what you do is you unlock more levels after that. And it has kind of a level up. Your profile can level up, sort of like something like a Modern Warfare 2, where you rise in rank, you know, based on how you perform. You get like a score from A to F at the end of each level, you know, like rookie, experience, expert, or whatever. And so it kind of entices you to keep playing rather than just, you know, at first I was like, okay, what, did I just beat the game? But then you realize, oh, okay, so you can go through and, you know, the better you perform, you'll unlock levels and you'll also unlock unique attacks. You'll unlock more ships. So it's kind of interesting. It almost adds sort of like an RPG element, like a little bit of an RPG layer on top of it. And I really don't know why more shooters don't do this. It seems like just shooters as a genre are kind of stuck in this rut of, okay, well, it's going to be 8 levels and it's going to be hard as hell.
Yeah, they're stuck in the late 80s, early 90s kind of design.
Yep. And I think that really turns a lot of people off to them, because I think that they're probably one of the genres that's, if you want to talk about casual gaming, well, you know, like from the early days of arcade, shooters have been around. And they really are kind of one of the more kind of casual genres, but they've gone away from that. And I think that Zoldner X does a good job of sort of bringing that back to the forefront.
I would say that the shooter genre hasn't been casual since the Intellivision. I mean,
well, I don't know if casual is the right word, but it is very highly exposed. I mean, how many people have never played Galaga or Defender? Even new kids have probably played Galaga in some bowling alley somewhere.
Yep.
So
new kids,
it is, and there's so many of these games over the years that it does seem like probably everybody has played one at some point or another. Whereas, you know, there's tons of people who never played a first-person shooter.
Yeah,
but like a shoot 'em up, because it's so old, they've been around for so long, and they haven't changed that much. I think you're right that it's something everyone's familiar with, at least.
Conceptually, it's very approachable. It's just usually the game designs are such that, you know, they just went in this direction where they catered to the niche of people that were buying them.
Right.
And the home console scene that just, you know, seemingly wanted it to be more and more complicated and difficult.
Well, the thing is, you can tell that they used to be designed, they used to be very difficult just to get another quarter out of you.
Quarter months, yeah.
And that design really never went away. So now you have these games that are really difficult for no real reason. Like the player doesn't really gain anything outside of, you know, some sort of satisfaction of being an expert at the game. I mean, either you devote hours and hours to the game and try to become an expert at it, or you probably don't play it at all. There's really no middle ground there. So I think Zoldner X is kind of an interesting sort of step in that direction. It kind of got me thinking about, you know, what could be done, because the shooter genre is the one genre that really hasn't changed much in decades. So I was thinking, like, I'd like to see something like sort of a shooter RPG, maybe something where you could play online with other people, have four ships on the screen at once trying to take down a boss, and everybody has a different role or something like that. And you could, you know, outfit. I think something like that would be really cool and just totally different from anything else out there. So
cool. Well, onto something you played on a Nintendo console.
Yeah. I remember Greg talking about this a while back, Musha for the Genesis. And I don't really have too much to say about it. You know, it's your basic kind of vertical shooter. But now Greg, this is kind of known as one of the more difficult shooters out there, right?
I think to some extent, I think it's pretty tricky. I found it pretty tricky when I played it. But then vertical shooters are not so much my thing.
Yeah,
they're very blast happy. You know, mm-hmm. it's just so much about it. Like there's usually in a lot of the more famous vertical shooters anyway. There's often not very much level design really.
Yeah,
it's just kind of waves and waves of enemies, and it's very power up leverage. You know, the firepower is absolutely essential to be able to clear the screen of the enemies that are assailing you, rather than like dodging. So I'm not really that attuned to these sorts of games relatively.
Yeah, the thing I found really difficult about Musha is the fact that your actual ship, your robot, is so large.
It's unusual.
Well, the problem is that they have parts of the, especially the bosses, one of the first bosses that you fight, there's these walls that move in from the left and right, and they box you in above and below and on the side, so you have to move to the left and right. But the problem is that your frickin' ship is so huge, and it's not really clear exactly when it will actually count a hit on you. So there's a lot of times when you'll run into the wall when you had no idea that it would actually register
As a hit. It goes even beyond just the fact you're playing this sort of almost square kind of hitbox, which is quite unusual for a shooter of any orientation.
Mm-hmm.
The way the game works sometimes is kind of unclear if you're getting hit, because you collect these little like power chips and you get satellite weapons and stuff, but you could be taking damage and not dying because it's not like a one-hit kill necessarily, but you will be losing those kind of weapons. And so, yeah, I found it quite odd. I mean, this one's by Compile, who've made plenty of it. There's a whole like Aleste series that this is connected to, because in Japan it's Musha Aleste, and they made one for the Super Nintendo, a lot of ones for the MSX and stuff, and they also made Blazing Lasers, which is a TG-16 game. And
Compile, they also made Chaos Legion and Radio Allergy, which came out on GameCube/Wii.
Well, wait, did it ever come out though? I thought it didn't. It just got killed.
I have a copy of it. I don't know if it ever.
I think they sent out review copies, and then it never survived.
Yeah. Well, you weren't missing much. Chaos Legion did come out in Japan because I have an import copy of that, and it's shit on GameCube.
Really? I mean, I have no idea how much they would have changed between the eras, if you know what I mean, in terms of who was around or not. But, I mean, a lot of those games are pretty good at what they do, good at pushing the systems that they're on, but they don't typically have this issue of the playing with the giant robot that makes the, you know, you kind of get used to playing shooters a certain way, and this robot kind of messes with that. You got to get used to it.
Yeah. I just found it kind of artificially difficult because of that.
So, John, it sounds like you're not that crazy about it. I mean, I saw so much competition on Virtual Console for if you want to shoot 'em up.
Yeah, I was kind of expecting it to be much better than it turned out to be. At least
it's very celebrated.
Yeah, I mean, I know somebody. I think somebody just wrote in a couple of weeks ago saying that Moosh is their favorite shoot 'em up on Virtual Console.
And they're wrong, apparently.
Well, I mean, I just don't see it. I mean, I think that there's a lot of other shoot-em-ups on Virtual Console that will grab you right out of the gate.
Some of it is what kind of brand of shooter you prefer, I think, is the first thing. Like I said,
yeah.
if you're kind of about the firepower and the amount of just crazy crap going on screen, definitely a vertical shooter or TG16 or Genesis is probably more likely to do it for you.
Yeah.
I mean, the one cool thing about this, I think, is when you do get those satellite weapons, you can like cycle through a bunch of different modes that they can do, so they can like roll around you or fire in three directions or fire behind you, or so you can adapt how you're kind of configuring your fire to some extent. So that's pretty cool, and you can change the speed of the ship, although that's done by a pause menu. So
really,
yeah, you actually have to stop the game, crank up or lower your speed, and then start again.
It's
not as smooth as it is in R-Type Delta and
or any other game ever.
I never would have thought of that. Like, I wouldn't even have imagined that it would be handled that way.
There's a few arrows on the top of the HUD.
Yeah. I didn't even know what they were. I mean,
I'm pretty sure you could do it in Blazing Lasers as well. It's more common in vertical shooters, that sort of thing.
Well, maybe that'll help you out, John, but
crank up that giant
probably
robot.
Not. Maybe I can just slow it down to helmet speed.
Now, was Musha an import title on Virtual Console?
No.
I can't remember. Some of the shooters were and some weren't, so...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's a number of games in the series that never came over, but this one did. Like I said, because it was Musha Aleste in Japan, and then they just changed it to a... ostensibly an acronym, Musha.
Right.
Yep.
I can't remember what the bloody L stands for.
It's like super hybrid armor or something like that. Like, yeah, it's something ridiculous. Like
mega. Thank you.
Multi-purpose.
Mega Uber.
It's like
mega
it's Uber, like multi-purpose super uniform hybrid. Super hybrid armor or something like that.
That's hot.
It's a mouthful.
We'll come
right
back
there.
To Virtual Console a little bit later, but Greg, you're up next.
Yeah, so following on from where I mentioned this last week, I have been playing Mirror's Edge. I've seen the credits of the game.
Oh, nice.
That's impressive.
It's quite short.
It is quite short, but it's not an easy game, no.
No, it's not easy. I suppose I certainly am ambivalent about it, similar to James. I'm not quite certain whether my ambivalence in itself is identical in the nature.
And I'm very ambivalent as well. And John, I can't remember if you played Mirror's Edge.
I haven't played it. I'm staring at it. It's sitting on my floor right now.
It's
but
huge.
I have yet to play it. Well, it's one of those games where I never plan to get it, but it was like for $10 somewhere, so I just grabbed it.
Well, yeah, I mean, John, it is like less than 10 hours long. Yeah. So
it's very short.
Yeah, I don't know if that's any motivation for you, but...
It's on the list somewhere. I've kind of heard, you know, some kind of middling opinions on it, so...
So, Greg, you were mentioning that you found Mirror's Edge to be pretty frustrating, and that's certainly not surprising to me, but...
That was part of a gag that we'll get to the punchline of a bit later. But, yes, it can be frustrating. I mean, for someone who plays Virtual Console games regularly, it's not that frustrating, because even though there's a heavy kind of trial and error element to the gameplay, you'll find yourself dying a lot where it was kind of... inevitable that you would die in a way. You know, you wouldn't necessarily get those sorts of things right the first time or whatever, because the checkpoints are very frequent and all this sort of thing. It didn't really bother me too much. You know, it's probably just a handful of occasions where it was for specific reasons it was really got on my nerves. But I mean, first of all, I should say visually, This is probably one of the most impressive games I've played on the PS3 for me. It was a very visually arresting game. I thought the sort of minimalist, dark aesthetic worked really well, kind of oppressively overexposed kind of look that they've got to everything.
See,
especially.
I think Mirror's Edge could have been, probably had a nice-looking version on the Wii. Because of the art style that it has, you know, it doesn't depend so much on, like, high-definition textures. There are very few textures, in fact.
Yeah, it's conceivable, yeah, with the sort of the white dominated, you know, kind of reminds me a little bit of some of the stuff in THX 1138, Will of Lucas's early films.
Or Portal, yeah.
Well, I think the difference, though, between that and what the Wii is capable of, though, is the smoothness of motion.
Sure.
Yeah, it could be, but I do feel like, and I noticed this as soon as I started playing Mirror's Edge, it felt weird to play it with dual joysticks. There was something, you know, because it's not really a shooter, you don't even have a gun most of the time. And I found that it just felt weird looking around with a joystick, and that's one of those cases where I feel like the game actually might have controlled better with a pointer.
Maybe, but I'm not sure that it would have worked as well if it didn't have the same, not fidelity.
Well, they probably would have had to add some fudge stuff in there, but in my opinion, they should have done that anyway. Like, that game is so demanding. There's no auto aim, there's no lock to something. A lot of platformers, including one I'll talk about a little bit later, have got this thing nowadays where because it's in 3D space, if you get kind of close to landing on something, your character will just stick to it. You know, there's a lot of that in Assassin's Creed and Prince of Persia and a lot of other Uncharted, a lot of games. And there is nothing like that in Mirror's Edge. You better stick it.
Yeah, I never had problems with that. For me, it was always the, can I make this fucking jump thing? It was like, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to make this jump, but it looks like it's the only place I can go. Well, let's see what happens, and then fall.
Well, I mean, what I kind of discovered with it as I went on in the game, really, it is short, but I still felt over that period of time, and I did enjoy it over that period of time, certainly, and it is quite a unique experience. It's a kind of uncompromising platform action, quite like an old school game, but at the same time, you know, because of the first person nature and the graphics and everything, it's, you know, it's very modern at the same time. So it's an interesting kind of combination of characteristics there. But what I found, even over that short length, was that it did not develop adequately for me. There was not, obviously, there's no gaining in the abilities. The gameplay doesn't really change substantively. I think the biggest change that tends to happen, first of all, is just that the whole runner vision element, where things are highlighted to kind of spell out the route that you're meant to take, becomes sort of gradually scaled back. And so it is less and less obvious what you're supposed to do, and you've got to kind of interpret it for yourself. That's fine to some extent. That kind of works. I think, you know, it's reasonable to expect that you could see the obstacles as a route yourself by that point. But also, the actual layouts become a bit more intricate, but just kind of more fiddly. Everything kind of becomes a bit more annoying. Everything's, you know, it's more likely that you'll do things inadvertently, and you've got to make a lot of little jumps in succession or things like this. They just amp up the sort of intricacy of it to a point where it becomes a bit cumbersome, I thought. And also, they do kind of ramp up the combat to some extent, which I didn't have a big problem with, but at the same time, I didn't find it to be tremendously fun or add a great deal to the game either. So the ways in which they kind of developed it later on was just a bit unsatisfactory for me.
I agree with all that.
But, you know, still I enjoyed it, definitely. I mean, the one thing I will say is that perhaps, I don't know if there's sort of elements of the level design that perhaps reveal certain things about themselves more if you were doing the whole time trial stuff. I mean, I've only dabbled with that a little bit. I did like the first level and got the qualifying time on it. Perhaps some more things about the levels kind of make sense to you if you can sort of shave seconds off your time doing advanced maneuvers and things like that. But just playing through it, you know, to the end in the normal progression, that didn't really strike me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I will move on now to my sort of antidote for something like Mirror's Edge, something a bit more soothing.
Something a bit more casual, maybe, a little bit more relaxing.
I'm excited next week, hopefully, by this time next week, depending on shipping, Metroid Other M will be with me.
So, see, if I can interrupt you, Greg, this is what I like about this next choice is I was just thinking, you know, how does Greg Leahy relax? How does he just chill out, unwind, kick back? How does he do it?
So I've been getting ready for Other M. I've been playing a little bit of Super Metroid here, a bit of Zero Mission there, a bit of Fusion as well. But how I really got myself ready for Other M was with Ninja Gaiden for the NES. It's the first time I've ever played it. Nice. On Virtual Console. It's on the European Virtual Console as an import game, despite the fact that it did actually come out in Europe. But,
what?
Yes.
Is it because they're doing the NTSC version that ran at normal speed?
Well, that's the good thing about it, is that because it's an import version, it's perfect. It's exactly like the original game, whereas the PAL version that was released back in the NES days would have been compromised. But it also wasn't called Ninja Gaiden, because this was back in the days where you couldn't really call anything ninja in Europe, like the Turtles or the Hero Turtles and so forth.
Hero Gaiden.
I assume that also played a part, because obviously since, you know, the Ninja Gaiden brand has caught on here, like with the HD games and all that, so, you know, they probably just wanted to release it under that name and everything. So, yeah, you get the proper version. It is on the Japanese Virtual Console, and there is, in fact, a PC Engine version of it on the Japanese Virtual Console, but apparently it's not that great. It's not really much of an improvement. The soundtrack is not even meant to be really any better. And also, there's a weird thing where apparently they added parallax scrolling.
They screwed it up
because the background layer actually scrolls faster than the foreground layer.
Oh, good God.
That's terrible. Which completely ruins the depth effect that it's meant to achieve. So I didn't bite on getting it on the Japanese services, and unfortunately there's no option for me to get Ninja Gaiden 2 instead, because on both PAL and Japan Virtual Consoles neither of the sequels are available, which I was quite surprised to find out that only America has 2 and 3, although apparently 3 is kind of buggered anyway because it hasn't got unlimited continues.
Yeah, 3 is probably my least favorite of the first 3. There's also a Super Nintendo Ninja Gaiden, it's called Ninja Gaiden Trilogy.
A trilogy,
and it has
yeah.
all 3 with better graphics, and that is not on Virtual Console.
Yeah, it's like Mario All-Star Syndrome, and they'd never put that out, I suppose. But I thought that was a little bit odd, so I only had one choice, really, which was the first one. And so, yeah, picked it up, and of course, you know, I'm a big Castlevania fan, as everyone should know by now. And this is a pretty famous Castlevania knockoff. I mean, that is what it is. You look at the player enemy bars on the top, and you're slashing candles to get stuff and sub-weapons and all that. I mean,
even right down to the way that you bounce back when you get hit.
Knockbacks there, yeah. I mean, the inspiration is very clear, especially versus the arcade game, which was like a brawler. So they kind of completely changed tack when they went to the NES and sort of made it a Castlevania clone. But the thing is, as hard as it's made out to be, you know, justifiably, the core mechanics of it are far more playable than the old school Castlevanias for me.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not nearly as stiff.
Yeah, exactly. He's a lot faster. Ryu is a lot faster. His jumping is much more sort of flexible. You've got comprehensive control over the jumping in the air. You can do the wall jumps. So it just, you know, it's very fluid. It plays great for an 8-bit game, I think. That part of it is really well done. But the problem really comes with, I mean, the level designs, I think, are okay in themselves. The bosses stink.
Yeah, they're not good. No.
No.
But, hey, look, the bosses in NES Castlevania are not good either.
I think Dracula, the Grim Reaper, have got something to be said for them, but some of the earlier ones are not great. But, you know, I mean, they're certainly not highlights. They're usually just kind of like, you know, races. You know, if you could get there with a good amount of health and then just, you know, give them a good hack and slash. But there's one whose attacks you literally cannot avoid. As far as I could tell. But if you get in there and start slashing him, it won't matter because you'll kill him first anyway. Rubbish. The real problem with the game is the enemy spawning. It's just broken. It's just awful.
Yeah. I think it's you're right. And I think it probably has to do with some technical limitations or the way that they dealt with the tiling sprite system on NES, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah, that, it seems like that, just intuitively. Because the way they're triggered, I've never seen the margin so fine in an 8-bit game.
Yeah,
right. And I mean, people complain about this in the Castlevanias and stuff, but it's like, well, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because, I mean, literally, you can come across an enemy, jump just a little bit in one direction to kill him, then jump back in the other direction and he'll reappear. You know, mm-hmm. just that one little bit of retreat that you made to kill him has then sort of reset everything.
Yep.
And so when you move forward again, he's back.
Yeah, enemies reset as soon as they're off screen.
It ends up making enemy management like a core skill of playing Ninja Gaiden. To the point where I'm not that good at action games. I mean, I'm decent, but I'm not great. But I can almost beat Ninja Gaiden because I know how to deal with that. I know how to deal with the enemy generation, you know.
There's sort of two modes. I mean, there's times where you need to keep pushing on for the reasons I say, you know, because if you don't, enemies will end up respawning and all that. But on the other hand, there's very many occasions where if you just keep pushing on, a bat that has a pattern very similar to a Medusa head will pop up. And you'll jump in midair and you'll be dead for sure. There is just no way. If you just run and jump without thinking, you are going to die for sure. You have to get to the edge, spawn it, stop, then let it come towards you, and then you can jump over it rather than into it.
Mm-hmm.
And those sorts of things, people talk about a lot of 8-bit games or, you know, Super Ghouls or Ghosts and memorization, but this is memorization. Because there is just no way in some of these circumstances, there is literally no way that you would be able to just like react to something and get out of it, even with the best timing in the world, because sometimes the enemy just spawns like that and you would have no chance. I mean, that it is that simple.
It's problematic, for sure.
It is problematic. But, you know, it's a bit of a shame, really, because there's so much rest about the game that I enjoy. And, yeah, I mean, you do kind of, you know, like I said, you learn the patterns, you get into kind of managing them, and then you go from there. So it's not insurmountable. I've still enjoyed it a lot. I've got right towards the end, I'll give you a clue as to what's happened on the last level. I actually got past the infamous 6-2 bit with the sort of rocket pack hailstorm ninjas.
Oh.
And then I got to a boss. But as you know, the continue system is bizarrely sort of idiosyncratic in that you can keep restarting from, say, 6-3. After having got past the hellish 6-2. But if you get to the boss after 6-3 and die, you go all the way back to 6-1. And, and then you have to do everything again. And you have to go through the nightmare, in particular, of the hailstorm ninjas again. So yeah, it's going to be tough for me to finish this because even for me mustering the will.
Don't beat yourself up over it.
Yeah, mustering the will to do that bit over and over
and
again.
You see, like, that was okay when that was all that kids had to play, you know what I mean?
I'm kind of skeptical whether this was ever okay.
Yeah.
Greg, now, you didn't mention the cutscenes.
The cutscenes, yeah.
Ninja Gaiden was one of the first games to have actual, like, cinematic cutscenes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the dialogue is not broken. I was surprised.
Right. It's decently translated.
Yeah, it's actually kind of cogent.
That stuff was a huge deal back in the day.
I mean,
when I first played Ninja Gaiden, I was blown away by it.
There wasn't
anything else like that on the NES that actually tried to tell a story with graphics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with, like, comic book graphics. That was incredible.
No, it's cool. I mean, that's one thing that I'm glad I've got an English version of, just to see what it was like. And, I mean, considering a lot of games at the time couldn't hardly seem to get two words right, because that's all they had to localize sometimes, and they'd still get it wrong. It's kind of cool that it is actually written all right, and it's executed quite well, I would say. Obviously, you do get a lot of just the same shot of his eyes His eyes, and he conveniently has his mouth covered up. Of course, that was
that's because it took up half the cartridge just for that one GIF or whatever it was. Bitmap, probably.
Yeah, it's sad but true, probably. But yeah, I mean, I think if there's any game, and obviously this is not a Konami property, so this doesn't really work. But if there's any game that could use with a rebirth game, it's this one.
Mm.
I think, you know, if you had a new 2D game with the same basic mechanics, but just obviously cleaned up all these kind of nasty 8-bit kind of technical limitations / just sadistic streak in it, and something along the lines of Castlevania Rebirth, but for Ninja Gaiden, I think it could be completely brilliant. I mean, obviously they've done stuff for DS and all that, but it's nothing like that at all.
Well, and, you know, Ninja Gaiden 2 improved on a lot. I mean, it plays very similarly to the first one, but they added a lot of cool features, and they cleaned up the technical parts of it. It's still really, really hard, but I think there's less of the enemy generation.
Yeah, see,
trickery.
That is what I had heard, but as I said, I didn't have the option, which was a shame.
I mean, the enemy patterns are still brutal. They will still send those orange eagles at you in the middle of your jump.
Yeah.
But that's just part of the game. You just have to learn to deal with that. And it feels amazing when you get past those parts.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, James is up next.
Yeah, so before I talk about a game, I want to do a quick run back to something I discussed quite a few months ago. Go back to, like, January. And the most important moment of my December through January period with regard to the show was the death of my Xbox. And if you all... it didn't die again. It didn't die again, just to be clear. It's still running like a champ. So, if you'll recall, I had a particularly bad time with the shipping.
Yes.
Yes.
The shoe?
There's a blog that documents
this. So does anybody want to recount the shoe incident, or should I go ahead and do it?
Well, the shoe incident, wasn't it they had a pair of shoes with your name on it? They had a pair of shoes in a box with your name on it, right?
Yes, they had shoes.
Yes.
not it's actually not a pair of shoes. It is multiple pairs of shoes. So I came home Tuesday, and there's a very large box sitting outside of my stair from Macy's. And I take it inside, and it's beat up. The box is just beat to hell. I mean, it's in rough shape. It's definitely my name on the shipping label. I cut the box open, because it's completely covered in packing tape now, because it's so beat to hell. And it's fucking pairs of shoes. Three pairs of shoes.
You're on some kind of shoe distribution list now. They think you write for a shoe blog.
Well, see, here's what's truly...
They're sending you review samples.
These are the shoes in question that ended up at Microsoft's repair facility, because I cut my packing label off to see where they were supposed to go, and sure enough, there's the one that I gave to the guy at the UPS store to put on my Xbox. So these shoes sat in a warehouse somewhere for 7 months before somebody shipped them back to me, even though they weren't mine.
This is absurd! I
have photographic evidence for when I post a blog about this, so nobody can refute this actually is happening.
What is up with these shoes? I mean, is this something that, like, did somebody try to, like, screw Microsoft and get them to think that this was
full
of, like...
So here's...
It's like the mask. You throw it out the window and it comes back and hits you in the face.
Here's what happened.
It's some kind of experiment, I'm sure.
I printed out my shipping label because Microsoft's support site is actually really good about this. It lets you either have them send you a box with the labels pre-printed, or you can just print it out yourself.
Yeah, Amazon does that too.
You can print out labels and take them to the post office, like on regular paper, and they'll put them in these clear plastic bags that are sticky on the back.
Right, yeah.
And that's how they handle the shipping. So this was a UPS label. I brought it and the box to UPS. And on December, I think it was the 6th, which is prime shipping season for them. And I brought it at lunchtime, which is probably one of their busier times of the day. And it would seem that the individual who was working there put my label on this box of shoes and put the label for my Xbox on a box that was headed to Macy's that was a return for these shoes because they were the wrong size.
Hmm.
So I find the note that the person wrote on there saying this is the sizes that they're supposed to be. It was an exchange slip, and they were requesting other sizes in exchange for them. So my first action thinking was, well, damn, these are those fucking shoes. Holy crap. So I looked around to see if I could figure out who they belonged to, and once I deduced that from the slip attached to one of these really, really, truly hideous leather slippers. I mean, they are hideous.
Those fucking
shoes. You should bronze them. Put them up on your wall.
So it's two pairs of leather slippers, none of which are in my size, and both of which are ugly.
None of which are in my size. Like, you would have worn them.
Just re-gift them, James.
So, well, no.
You got your Christmas presents already.
Hold on. No, because they're hideous. I would never give them to anybody.
Dirty Santa.
And a pair of leather boots that when I was speaking to my sister, she asked what size they were and was upset when she heard they weren't her size. But,
I know what I'm getting for Christmas from James. From Secret Santa. Oh my god, it's shoes. It's hideous leather sandals.
Hey, John, do you wear a size 8 by any chance?
No, but I could probably find a homeless man that does.
So, I find the name on the return label. I look it up in the phone book, just for shits and giggles, to call and be like, because the address is actually right near my work, which is where I dropped it off at the UPS store near work. I'm like, well, shit, I'll just call them. Yeah, they moved. So, they're in the phone book under that name with that address. I call, yeah, nobody here by that name lives here. I'm like, okay. So either they moved or they're in trouble with the law, and either way, I don't want to find out. So I call Macy's and be like, what's the hell deal with these shoes?
How much are these shoes worth to you?
The order is so old that it's archived, and she has to go call somebody else to get access to it, at which point they deduce that, oh yeah, we just refunded the person the money on them. So they're now sending me a shipping label to mail these year-old shoes that have spent the last 10 months in the postal system to them. Just for the hell of it. Because I don't want these fucking shoes. But that has been, hopefully, end of this particular saga, although I doubt it.
That is an odyssey.
Wow. Wow. Evil never dies.
Yeah. So, the game I have played the most this week, because I'm still playing a lot of the games from last week, but the game I played the most this week was Monday Night Combat on Xbox Live Arcade.
Terrible name for a game.
It is. I mean, the premise of the game is the TV show.
Yeah, but this game came out on a Wednesday.
And you can play it every day, so
you can play it. It's just a bad game title.
So this game is, I mean, a lot of people refer to it as a derivative of Team Fortress 2, which I guess it kind of is.
I've heard that it's kind of like a Dota clone, which is Defense of the Ancients, which is a mod of Warcraft 3.
I actually think I actually equated it closer to like a Tribes clone. So like old school Tribes 2 stuff.
Are there jetpacks?
Well, one character has a jetpack, yes. Although it's not particularly fast like in Tribes 2, where when you hit the jetpack, you might go slam yourself into a wall. But basically the idea is that there are a series of classes of character you can pick from, and each one has their own special skills. And they are heavily leveraged on Team Fortress 2 classes. Mm-hmm. But the game is much more intimate than even Tribes is, because the enemy base is like 50 steps away. I mean, it's really close. But you can build defense systems like you can in Tribes, with big turrets and things. And it's not just one class. You can build a turret, but you build many turrets. And the idea is that you have to get to the enemy base and destroy their money ball, essentially. So what you do is you have to escort these robots that spawn from your base to their base to deactivate its shields, and then you just shoot it till it dies. That's basically the premise of the game.
So you're protecting these robots.
Yes.
I think that's where the Dota part comes in.
I mean, these robots can fight on their own too, but they're not, except for maybe one or two classes of them, not real dangerous. So it's probably the ultimate rage quit game on Xbox Live, because there's no dedicated servers on Xbox. So if somebody rage quits and happens to be hosting the game, that's it. The game's gone. I mean, it just goes. So we've had that happen a couple times. It's a pretty rage-inducing game, because every class feels broken, but they're all equally broken. So it's like every class has some ability that they probably shouldn't have. So there's an assassin class that can cloak itself. Gee, I wonder where that came from. But it's so much worse than the cloaking in Team Fortress 2, because A, it lasts longer. And B, the stages are so much smaller. So you can basically walk the entire distance of the stage if you fully upgraded your cloaking while invisible. And then there's these melee attacks you have at close range that are basically instant kill. So with the two, like, that particular class feels horribly unfair because you can just walk up behind everybody and kill them. There's a sniper class that can hit anybody from anywhere on the screen because all of the levels are so tiny. So that feels really fucking unfair. There are classes that take a ton of damage that they don't feel particularly fair. So nothing about this game feels fair at all. So no matter what class you're in, you feel like you're getting ripped off. It's great. So everybody ends up with these either really ridiculously high or really tiny, terrible scores. So it'll be like either you get 30 kills or you get like one and you die 55 times. I mean, it's fun, but it's a lot of fun. But the first thing I do in every game is mute every person in the locker room. Because otherwise you just get fuck endlessly while you go through the game. And it's like, I don't need this.
And that's in addition to the racial slurs and the misogyny.
I haven't heard a whole lot of racial slurs yet, but since I mute everybody now, I won't get the chance to anymore. Except for right. Somebody slips in right before the game starts, and then you're like, damn it, I hear somebody. That bastard, how dare he join the game before I can quit? It's kind of a funny game. So you get, when you kill enemies, be they robots or people, you get money, and you use money to buy and upgrade turrets. And there's places where you can build a turret. Buy special robots. Like there's a really large robot you can spawn that takes a lot of effort to take down and does a lot of damage to everything around it. Or you can upgrade your skills. And each class has four skills that they can upgrade three times for a certain amount of currency. So the idea of the game is to basically collect as much money as you can until your team essentially gains momentum enough to wipe out the enemy's money ball. The problem is that either games go really quick because one team establishes momentum and never lets up on it, or the games inevitably end in ties. It's a very weird experience with that particular game because it's either there's instant stalemate or nearly instant victory. I've never had a game end after a long, protracted fight, where somebody finally gains the upper hand and wins. It seems to be directly dependent on how many people you're playing with as to how much fun it is. So I played a game really late at night, like 3 in the morning, and there weren't a lot of people on, so it was a really small match. And basically, I just rampaged through their bots for the entire match and didn't really encounter a whole lot of resistance because they were all doing the same thing.
I was surprised when I found out that you were going to be talking about this, James. This is more of something John would play and talk about.
I could see John playing this game. I mean, it's part of the reason I described it as kind of a Tribes game, even though Tribes has huge levels versus this one, which are really tiny, is that a lot of the danger comes from just the fact that you're running around on these environments that you can fall off the edge or you can blast people off the edge. The game's all in third person, which Tribes did have a third person mode. That's how I chose to play it personally. But it's very fast. Like even the spawn time is pretty quick. So, I mean, you can get killed and be back in the match quickly and then die again from that same fucking sniper about 30 seconds later. Mm-hmm. So he can basically rack up 30 kills on you in 15 minutes. But that's fine, because the entire game's like that. But I think it's definitely worth the money. It can be incredibly frustrating, because you'll inevitably encounter somebody who so knows how to game whatever class they specialize in that they become unkillable machines.
Yeah, I always question, like, games like that probably haven't been put through the testing paces as much as, like, a full-blown first-person shooter or something like that.
Right, well, there's no PC version, which means there's no beta.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
Well, see, what's interesting, though, and I read this in an article somewhere, and it was one of the things that interested me in this game, besides it getting a lot of positive feedback, and it being at every media event I've attended since March. Because remember, it was playable at PAX East. Wow. They had a big setup for it over near the place where John was stealing all the free point cards.
It wasn't stealing, it was borrowing.
What was interesting was they were doing an interview with somebody, and they noted that Microsoft actually designates a small amount of space on their server for every Xbox Live game that you can put whatever you want up there. So what they've put up there are these text files that are basically the stats for every character or every class. Mm-hmm. So if they find that a game's unbalanced, they can adjust the stats for that particular class to try to reestablish balance. So every time you connect to Live, you go up to that server and grab that file and adjust the stats for that character.
So they won't have to recertify a bunch of patches for the game.
Exactly. That is why they did it. They will never have to patch to balance the game. They can just change variables, which is a pretty ingenious idea. But, I mean, it's not that the game's unbalanced. It's that every character has some stupid advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as our listeners might have gathered, it's been a slow week in the world of Nintendo. It's been a slow month, I would say, since Sin and Punishment, probably, and Dragon Quest VIII. But, you know, we're all sort of gearing up for Metroid. That's why James is playing these XBLA games. And
yes, I'm gearing up for not playing Metroid. Exactly.
Right, right, exactly. The way I've handled it is, I'm still playing a few things. I'm still playing some Dragon Quest and StarCraft II and Mother 3, actually, I played some more of, so I'm hoping to finish that extremely soon. I want to do kind of a spoiler segment on it, maybe with Neil, since he's beaten it. But anyway, that's for the future. What I'm talking about this week is, first off, I bought a virtual console game, a new virtual console game.
That's the really notable thing. It is actually came out recently.
Right. There is a new virtual console game. It's an import NES title called Euphoria The Saga. And Euphoria is spelled Euphoria. Yikes. It's a pretty awful title, but hey, it was the early 90s. I'll give them.
We were all younger then.
Yes.
John was 30.
Yep.
Euphoria the Saga is a game that I had only heard the title of, knew nothing about before Monday when it came out on Virtual Console. I watched, actually I didn't even watch any videos. I looked at some screenshots of it and read a couple of write-ups about it on the internet and was like, okay, I'm buying this because it's pretty much like Super Mario 2, because you've got these four characters and they each have unique abilities, and it's a platformer mixed with Metroid or maybe Blaster Master, because it has this one world that is basically open to you. It's very non-linear, and the goal of the game is to first find you start out with only one of the characters, so the first goal is to kind of find all four characters so you have all their abilities, but also find a bunch of items that give them new abilities that let them get to places they couldn't get before. So you get improved jumping, you can stick to walls, you get special attacks for each one of them, but the primary mechanic of the game is jumping around and stomping on dudes' heads like Mario. So it's a really weird kind of hybrid thing. I've never played a game quite like it, I don't think, and it's, as you might guess, it's totally up my alley. The other really cool thing about Euphoria is that it, and by the way, this version is in English, even though it never came out in the US, because it was released, apparently in very limited quantities, was released in the UK and Australia in the early 90s. So this is the PAL version being basically, it's not sped up for the US, but the music is apparently slower. Or something.
Well, the music timing's off. I think the music's actually too fast, because what's happening is the reverse of what happens when the crappy PAL conversions of the past. With the crappy PAL conversions of the past, the games would get sort of squashed down and slowed down, and the music would slow down accordingly. Right. And whereas what's kind of happened here, from 50 hertz to 60 hertz, is that the music is getting sped up. So you've had some similar problems, I think, with like when they did a special PAL conversion of Super Mario Brothers that actually corrected the game speed, but that also screwed up the music speed. So if you play PAL Super Mario Brothers, the music's actually too fast, which makes the Bowser Castle sound bizarre.
I can imagine.
You can't really discern any kind of music at all.
And I guess the music emulation here is bothering some people who had fond memories of it from their European childhoods. But for me, not a problem. You know, the music still sounds fine, even though it's apparently not at quite like it was originally intended. It still sounds fine, and I have no basis for comparison, so it doesn't sound weird to me. It sounds like NES music. But the nice thing is, this was a late NES game. It came out in like 92 or 93, so it benefits from a lot of Sunsoft's graphical expertise by that time. So it actually has big characters, very colorful, really nice use of color throughout the entire game, actually. It's very colorful for an NES game. It doesn't look all washed out like some others do. The animation is spectacular. Really smooth, really funny animations. And really, I think other than the great game design, which I don't know what to say about it, because, you know, it is basically Mario 2 mixed with Metroid. I mean, you have a pretty good idea of what that means, and the levels are pretty well designed, and so it all works together. It's fairly easy, I would say. I mean, if you're used to NES style games, it's not that hard. which I kind of like because I've actually been able to, I get to the final boss in 3 or 4 days. So I'm actually going to beat this Virtual Console game, which rarely happens. But, I mean, it's only $6. It's still a fine value. And it's a very rare, sort of obscure game that is surprisingly high quality for something that you've probably never seen before. So I would definitely recommend it if you like this kind of game.
No, I mean, I'd be interested in this, but I think I'm going to bide my time until it comes out on the Japanese Virtual Console.
It may not.
Blaster Master made it eventually. You know, it took a while, but I mentioned it just a few weeks ago, which was, you know, a good 6 months or so after it came out in America.
Well, maybe I can ping Vic Ireland and ask him if they have any plans for Japanese release, because
what happens with it over there. But of course, what that would be a 60 hertz version with the music being intact.
Sure. You would love it. Definitely, Greg. I think a lot of our listeners would love it as well. And, it's also crazy psychedelic. I mean, this game is so bizarre. It's so funny. The characters are just messed up. And the enemies, every single sprite in the game is so absurd and funny. And they have these really crazy, weird animations. One of the characters crawls on his back. If you duck and then move, he crawls on his back. The main character, once you get the ability to climb on walls, it looks like he's humping the wall when he climbs it. And I think that's on purpose, you know? Like, the animation quality is good enough that I don't think there's a whole lot of accidents in the way this stuff works. They're meant to be funny, and they really are. Very, very charming game. That's Euphoria, and yeah, the thing about this year on Virtual Console is, even though we've had it very, very, very few releases, almost all of them have been really good.
Are you suggesting they're being super, super selective?
No, it's just that...
It's just coincidence.
It's just been half of them have been Sunsoft games, which are generally pretty good. Mm-hmm. So you've got Blaster Master and Era the Acrobat and now Euphoria. And then, you know, Nintendo's done a couple things like Ogre Battle, and then Konami did Rondo of Blood. So I think it's just coincidence, but a lot of the shitty releases have already been done, or the companies just aren't interested.
Or they're bankrupt.
But anyway, it is really good. So... The other game that I'll talk about this week is Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light, which is a download title. It's out on Xbox now, and it's coming to PlayStation 3 in September,
I think. When they put the online co-op in the other version, it's going to happen at the same time, like PC, PSN.
Right, and I'm looking forward to going back and playing it once they patch in the online, because I think that could be quite interesting. And there's some achievements for doing that as well, but the game is totally worth playing and worth buying, even if there were no online co-op. I am amazed by it. I'm extremely impressed by it, and very, very happy that I bought it, regardless of online multiplayer. I don't even give a shit about that, really. And I'm not a Tomb Raider guy. Never have really liked those games very much. Never have thought they were very good. Even the first one and the second one, which people think are like the only good ones in the series. So I kind of played the demo on a whim and was totally sold on it after like 5 minutes. I was like, oh geez, it is so different from any Tomb Raider game. It's so much better than any Tomb Raider game. And the weird thing about this Guardian of Light thing is that I'm not sure I know a game to even compare it to. I mean, it's basically an isometric puzzle platformer. Maybe Solstice and Equinox? I never played those, but it's shocking how well the platforming works in isometric view. And I think it's partly that there's a lot of sticky jumping, so if you land near where you're trying to get to, it will just put you there. And you can see that sometimes. You can kind of see that happening. But, I don't know, the controls are just really good. Very rarely will you jump off into a void when you didn't mean to or anything like that. It's just really, really tight. And the combat is shockingly fun, especially considering it's a Tomb Raider game. They've always had terrible combat. And it basically works like a twin stick shooter. I mean, that's how you control it. And you do tend to have enemies sort of coming in from all directions. And you just kind of have to manage that much as you would in a Geometry Wars or something like that. The enemies tend to die pretty quickly, but they come in large amounts. And you have awesome guns. to shoot them with. And the game gives you new guns. Pretty much every level you'll get one or two new guns. And they just feel really satisfying. There's some strategy in which weapons you use because they do play out very differently, like machine gun versus pistols versus a rocket launcher versus your spear. They all control very differently and they have different pros and cons. And then you have this landmine thing that you can run around and set the bomb and then run away from it and push the button again and it'll blow up.
Oh,
and
nice.
That thing is surprisingly fun to use. That's like the first thing you get in the game. The opening cinema is Lara showing this Totec guy how to use those. And right off the bat, I thought the landmines were really surprisingly fun to use. So the other thing I want to highlight about the game is that it has absolutely excellent puzzles. Great level design all over, but the levels are full of puzzles, and there are all these like challenge rooms that you can go into that are like separate puzzles unto themselves that are totally optional. You get like prizes for beating them. You get like bonus items. And these are just purely puzzles. I mean, there's no combat in these rooms usually, and the puzzles are amazing. They're great. I'm shocked at how good they are.
I'm going to go back and count how many times you've said shocked, amazed,
I am.
Stunned.
I can't believe how much I like this game. Seriously, it's like one. It's probably one of my top games of the year so far. And I would not have if I heard myself say that a week ago, it would have slapped me. But
I still will if you want.
It's fantastic.
We all
it's,
will.
I very highest recommendation. That's Lara Croft, Guardian of Light, and
is that
damn,
the clean sweep for the Summer of Arcade between you and James?
James, did you get the Castlevania monstrosity?
Oh no, of course though. What's got how many of assets?
I wasn't. Sorry.
I feel like we failed.
I don't know if I played that at E3, but I watched it at E3, and I was like, "What the fuck?"
I watched it with Carly just sitting there with nobody playing it, just the sprites just standing there going, what is going on?
Yeah, no, I read a lot about the Harmony of Despair or whatever it's called, and just decided that I had no interest in it.
It just sounds hilarious.
It's like an online multiplayer Castlevania. I have no interest in that.
It's like a fan hack Castlevania. I mean,
right? It's like that Super Mario crossover flash. but I don't even know if it's that good. I actually, the turning point was I read Jeff Gerstmann's review over at Giant Bomb. And he basically said, as a single-player game in particular, it's awful. Like, there may be some redeeming value for playing it co-op, you know, but as a single-player game, hell no.
So, the Igarashi let the side down, and they're almost there.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the Summer of Arcade is usually a lot of good stuff. I don't buy that many live arcade games throughout the year, but Summer of Arcade, it's typical for me to buy three or four of them. But yeah, Lara Croft is the last of that set and the best, I think. I like it a lot better than Limbo. Sorry. Limbo's getting a lot of like really exaggerated praise, I think, right now. And again, I like that game, but it's not like the best game ever. I enjoyed Lara Croft far more, and it's the same price. Anyway, that's gonna wrap up new business. Next week we should have at least early impressions of Metroid Other M, so please look forward to that.
But more importantly, enjoy your massage.
That's right.
Yeah, John, you should be.
John's having trouble downloading that, but
bullshit.
Yeah, I think
working out the kinks.
Shit.
Yeah, it's hard stuffing all the massage oil into my Wii.
Stuffing all
it's
that
just tough.
Oil
it's just
Wii.
Tough. It kinda gunks it up, so
oh, dear God.
It's too bad WiiWare games don't come with their own peripherals.
Oh, no. It
prophylactics, did you say?
No, peripherals.
Oh, okay.
I'm having difficulty downloading that game, too, because it disgusts me.
I wish Enjoy Massage came with a special animation for Mario and Luigi while it downloads.
No!
Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will have your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Alright, this week on the website, we've got Flip's Twisted Evolution Part 2. This is a new developer journal from Frozen North's Douglas Gregory, and he gives us a final look at the development process behind Flip's Twisted World, although I think the journal is to continue. but you can find out what development challenge they faced on the Wii, moving the title from Xbox 360 actually to a Wii title, and what design obstacles they had to overcome during that process.
Neil reviews Pro Pack Mini, this mini Wii Remote Nunchuck, and tells us whether or not they're worthwhile. How is their battery life? Are the buttons and analog stick better than Nintendo's controller? Neil answers all this in his review. And we also have a blog from Matt Walker about the Gunpei Yokoi exhibit. He checked out this exhibit about the father of the Game Boy, Gunpei Yokoi. Check out his pictures and thoughts on this incredibly cool event.
Yeah, there's some great pictures in there. That's awesome.
Father of the Virtual Boy as well, thank you.
Yes.
We also have Aaron's impressions of Ivy the Kiwi, which, yes, the question mark is part of the title.
Stay classy, San Diego.
He has some hands-on time with Yuji Naka's latest title and tells us what he thinks about the art style and the multiplayer modes.
And the controls.
We also have Nathan's second review, he's quite an industrious individual, for Dragon Ball Origins 2, Additional Origins, at which point Nathan explores the Zelda-style adventure from the Dragon Ball series. He enjoyed the story and combat, and you'll have to go see what he didn't like in the review.
All right, and on the review front, we also have Monkey Madness Island Escape for the DS from James, our own James Jones. Takes us on a tour of this DS on-rail shooter and lets us know that the game is short. Is this a good or a bad thing? Read his review to get the answer.
It should be bad, but in the context, it's not.
All right, and in the blog arena, we have Neil's Better Late Than Never NHL 2K10 on the Wii. Neil takes a look back at NHL 2K10, a surprisingly solid entry in a very rare genre on Wii, that being the hockey game. He tells us why you should be hyped for NHL 2K11 based on the quality of this 2K sports title.
Yeah, Wii is getting two hockey games.
I'm about to say, yep. The rare hockey game, there's two coming out, John.
That's the website, people. Check it out on NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, and we're back for part two of Radio Free Nintendo, episode 208. And this is when we read your listener emails and talk about them.
And make fun
of them.
And
it's the best part of the show because our listeners are the best, and they send the best emails. The email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. John has the first letter.
Plugabugs from London writes, Dear RFN, you guys rule. End. Anyway, my question. We know in intimate detail about James's love about box art, but what about other games that unintentionally put something on there that makes you chuckle? For me, on the UK copy of De Blob for Wii, on the back it says, quote-unquote, basic reading ability is required to fully enjoy this game. I have attached an image of it. If I didn't know how to read, then I wouldn't be able to read that, right? What other gaffes have you seen? Anything that has unintended results?
I mean, that line is for parents who might be buying the game for their children.
Now, if the blob were rated 18, then we'd have a problem.
Right. It is, you know, a very kid-friendly game, but I have to think of, I mean, you know, of course we all know the Mega Man box art, the Boom Blocks Bash Party, which is James's favorite.
Ikaruga, with its frothing anticipation of this game.
Both Boom Blocks covers are really terrible, but Bash Party
to me,
is
Bash
like...
Party takes it because it marginalizes its own name. You can't beat that.
It's got that weird, like, 32X stripe going down the side, too.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
With the actual name of the game. And it's made the Spielberg part so small as to require a magnifying glass.
Some of our younger listeners might not be all that familiar with the original Mega Man box art. And it is amazing. So definitely do your little Google search for that.
Your little Google search?
Is it Mega Man Universe or whatever, the trailer?
Yes.
The claymation, if you can see that represented in that trailer.
It's a very self-referential trailer.
Yeah, well, we actually still don't know what Mega Man Universe is.
No, but there's also Rockman Online has a trailer out too, so don't confuse the two.
Oh,
which we don't really know what that is either, besides the fact it's an MMO.
It's I can't really think of a gaff, but there is that bizarre box art for a shooter.
Phalanx,
yeah, with the banjo playing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just an old man sitting on a porch, and it's a space shooter. It's a shoot 'em up, and the only reference to that is that over his head, like off in the black of night, over his head, you can kind of see this like streak or something, and it's supposed to be like there's an alien ship flying overhead, but like 90% of the box art is this picture of this old dude on a porch playing banjo.
Which honestly
so weird.
Really weird.
Honestly,
really.
I don't mind the crusty dude with the banjo box art though, because I understand that they wanted to stand out. I mean, it's not
I think it's great. I mean, yeah. I'm with you.
Well, we're still talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's not like that game is really worth talking about, to be honest.
I've never played it. You know, they actually re-released that in not as a virtual console game, but as WiiWare in Japan for some reason. Like, it was somewhat upgraded, but not very much.
The issue with that game is that its box art is so bizarre that we all remember it. So
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of really, really good shooters that had utterly forgettable box art. I mean, that was supposedly good at the time, you know what I mean?
And when you guys mentioned the Ikaruga thing with the IGN quote,
yeah.
The frothing man, but I would say Okami on Wii, which has IGN watermark on it.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that was awful.
So this is a not good game, but I've always laughed at this box art from the minute I saw it, and we've never had an opportunity to discuss it on the show. But it's monkeys, I think it's called Family, something like that, where it's got a bunch of monkeys on it, which, you know, whatever. But on the right-hand side, there's one monkey laying on top of another monkey, and they're making some suggestive facial expressions. It is truly
okay.
Strange. And I just think to myself when I saw it, how did nobody think, man, this looks like a bad picture? Maybe we shouldn't do this.
Is this one of those Ubisoft monkeys games?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So the primary picture is a giant monkey, but on the side, there are two that look like they're engaged in intercourse.
Nice.
Well, that's what's always amazing is that the fact that, I mean, this box art, it goes through multiple levels of, you know, approval. At least I should hope so.
That one didn't.
The ESRB has to approve it, I know that.
Yeah.
It's not a box art issue, but one thing that always surprised me was that, you know, sort of, was it in the manual or something, was the artwork for Twilight Princess, which kind of gave away an element of the ending.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised by that at all.
The non-chibified Midna is pictured
right.
In the art. I mean, that's kind of shocking.
I want to make a couple addendums to my list. everything ever published ever in the history of existence by Storm City Games and Zoo Games have some of the worst box arts I've ever seen. And I'm holding Monkey Island, which I noted in the review, the hand-drawn graphics actually look worse than the game.
It's don't call it Monkey Island, James. That's
Monkey
very
Madness.
Disrespectful.
Sorry. Monkey Madness Island Escape. And it is a Storm City game, and its box art looks like it was drawn by horrible people. Just terrible. It's horrible.
Oh, here's another one in the Phalanx category somewhat. Do you remember the box art on the N64 for Forsaken?
I played that game, I think. But
it's just half of a woman's face with like a little tear running down her cheek and like just some sort of wasteland behind it. Because the game was post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, kind of. But that game is basically Descent with different graphics, I think.
Oh,
there's no like female character in the game.
No. And there's no overground, so you're only just going through sort of, you know, very mechanical tunnels.
Yeah, you're always in tunnels.
It's so random.
Doesn't, what's it called, Ju-on the Grudge have a really shitty European box art? Like it's some person hiding behind a chair or something.
That could have been the box art for Metroid Prime 3. Dude hiding behind a chair.
Yes, it is. It is a person hiding behind a chair. That is the box art. Thank you, Rising Sun Games. Perfect.
Oh, I did see on actually not on the box, obviously, because there is no box, but for Lara Croft, the one I just talked about in New Business, it has a seizure warning, which is not unusual, and it shows when you first turn the game on, it shows the seizure warning. But it also has it at the very end of the credits. So when you beat the game, the very last thing you see is a seizure warning. What possible purpose could it serve at that point? You've already played the game for 8 hours.
If you have had really a seizure in the last 8 hours, I think I might know the cause. I just wanted to let you know.
FYI, once you take out the tongue suppressor, you might want to, stop playing this game. Oh, you just beat it.
Okay, there's a few examples for you, Plug of Bugs. And Greg has the next letter.
Andrew from Ohio, a.k.a. XC Warrior, writes, I found your podcast this summer and have been loving it. Okay, not the first episode I listened to, the Magic the Gathering podcast.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Sorry.
But after that, it's been great.
thank you for sticking with us.
No wonder he thinks we're amazing. He's seen the worst.
So here's my question. For what seems like at least a year, Nintendo has really pulled back on their virtual console releases and are shipping more WiiWare titles instead. Some good, but a lot of junk. Then they say WiiWare sales are up and VC is down, but it goes without saying when there are no new VC games to buy. Do you know why this is? Do you guys download a lot of VC titles? And has anyone asked if they would bring back the demo service or start doing deals of the week like the other two systems?
So, I'm not familiar with any cases of Nintendo actually like complaining that virtual consoles sales have gone down. Have you guys heard anything like that?
I think it's just that they've released figures that show they've gone down. I don't really know.
That
doesn't necessarily amount to them complaining about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's no surprise that sales have gone down. Cause
yes,
there aren't
very
any.
Much so. Indeed, it is inevitable that they would have done it in many ways. And it seems certainly that, you know, a good bulk of virtual console sales do actually continue to be people buying, you know, the really big legacy titles like Super Mario 3, DKC, and so on when they first buy a system. And of course, as Wii hardware sales are slowing down now, that will also cause VC sales to slow, in addition to the sort of paucity of new games on it.
I've never heard that WiiWare sales are all that great either, though.
But they are growing, I suppose, is the thing, because, I mean, WiiWare has increased in frequency. So again, just, you know, arithmetically, you would expect it to grow.
Well, I know World of Goo did well, but at the time there was fairly little competition on the service. And now you've got 5 games a week coming out, and it's very hard to tell which ones are decent and which ones aren't.
Yeah, I hear a lot more of games selling well on Xbox Live.
Well, they promote them so heavily. I mean, all we get every week is a really, really... Well, it's a press release written by a crazy person. I mean...
Yeah, and the average person doesn't see that press release. They might hear it on the giant Bombcast, but they don't see it.
I mean, that's all we get.
Yeah, no, you're right. They don't do anything on Nintendo Channel for Virtual Console.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, in Japan, they have 30-second videos for virtual console games.
That would be something, wouldn't it?
It would literally be something.
It is always someone booting up the game, and then the title screen, and then the next 20-odd seconds that are left over. It's never, like, here's an exciting part of the game. It's always like, this is the first 30 seconds that you will experience when you boot up this off your Wii. I'd love the no-frills approach. I think Andrew brings up some key points that we kind of made before when we've discussed this subject in terms of there are things you could do to gin up interest in the virtual console, even if you're not necessarily going to have more games coming out for it, you know, because you could have demos or you could have deals. I mean, that's, you know, certainly what you get on PSN, and I would imagine Xbox Live as well, is, you know, just another reason to keep people coming to the shop, even if there's not a specific release that they're interested in. Maybe, you know, if they know that there's new deals up there once every week or 2 weeks or whatever, then that's a reason to come back and look, and, you know, that's more probability that they might actually bite on something at some point.
Well, I hate to be so blunt, but Nintendo doesn't know what the fuck they're doing with Virtual Console, and they never have.
Mm-hmm. It just seems to be an indifference to it as well, though.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, because Andrew's coming in this summer, he could go back to episode 160. No, 167 was with Billy, so it isn't that one. But there's an episode in that area, I think it's probably in the one late 150s, that deals with the virtual console in a feature. And the sad thing is that in that time, which is, you know, pretty much a year,
things have gotten worse.
The trends have only continued in that direction. You know, any of the things that we discussed about, you know, what you could do to reinvigorate the service or, you know, change things up a bit just, you know, haven't been done. They've continued on that trajectory to the point now where it is, you know, a game a month, a game every 3 weeks,
yep,
and nothing more to promote the catalog titles.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that Virtual Console is, I think, one of the best things that's ever happened to video games.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of there being a perpetual digital archive of legitimate classic game releases that are affordable, including a lot of really obscure stuff that's otherwise extremely difficult to get.
Yep.
It's amazing, and I've spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars on it. I have over 50 Virtual Console games.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily play them all that often. I'm certainly less likely than Greg, for instance, to go back and play something that I downloaded 2 years ago. I rarely do that just because I have too many current distractions. But I love Virtual Console, and it's a testament to how much I love it that I have used it as much, because Nintendo hasn't made it easy. From the cleaning the fridge days looking, it's just hard to even find things on it.
Yeah, it's just interesting. Nintendo is always fascinating to me, just what they do really well and what they do really, really poorly. And just anything online, downloading anything, they just do it really poorly.
But I want the things that they're putting up there.
Exactly.
So I'm willing to deal with it, but I'm not happy about it.
Yep. I mean, the thing is, again, and I've said this before, I have money that I want to give to Nintendo. I do. There's tons of games. There's still tons of VC games that I would like to buy, but they just aren't out there, and they're not going to get my money. They could have it. It's sitting right here for you, Nintendo. Come and get it.
You laugh, but your door's about to get broken down.
I mean, I suppose we're running also into certain questions about the cost-benefit side of Virtual Console. You know, at what point are we now thinking that some of the omissions, like Yoshi's Island, for instance, or Star Fox for the Super NES, is that because there is more effort involved, and even though those are really famous games with a good fan following, that they're looking at the economics of it based on the sales of other games and are reluctant to do so? Or in other cases, it's less obvious what the explanation would be. For instance, as we've mentioned before, Pilot Wings for the N64, just about every other major early N64 game is up there.
Even Cruisin' USA.
Yeah,
exactly.
Explain that one.
Which I owned on cartridge. God help me.
Yeah. Those are dark days indeed.
I'm still kind of reticent to believe that it's all about the kind of brass tacks of cost and the expected return. But that may be a factor. And of course, I assume that would be more of a factor for other companies rather than Nintendo's, which, you know, have a certain kind of bankability to them. I mean,
right,
it's good to see some sort of entrepreneurial kind of activity going on here with what Vic Island is doing with the Sunsoft stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you got to imagine, especially something like Euphoria, which is hyper obscure, import title, NES game, most people never heard of it. It's a fairly sophisticated game design. It's not that easy to pick up and play. And it's so late in the Wii's life. How many people are really going to buy that? Yeah, I mean, it has no publicity. It has very little word of mouth because it's just not well known. It's a fantastic game. And how many people are seriously going to go buy that? I feel bad for them. I don't know what the cost is to put something on Virtual Console. I know there is a cost associated. There's an upfront cost. You have to get it rated for ESRB. But you have to, you know, there's a lot of manpower to get it certified through Nintendo, to get all the emulation checked out and everything. You know, it's not free, so it's costing him something, and I just wonder, are they making their money back? I don't know.
I guess some of the issue is, you know, when you think of emulation, you think of, oh, well, there's all the stuff online, how hard is it and all that, but, I mean, the games do have to run pretty much watertight to get approved.
And I think Nintendo is very adamant about the quality of emulation.
Well, there is one exception I could think of across all the VC regions where that was broken. And it was the Last Ninja 3 for the PAL Virtual Console. It actually had a bug in it that meant the game would crash at a certain point and you wouldn't be able to progress any further. And this problem was actually sufficiently bad for the game to be withdrawn from the service altogether.
Wow, I've never heard this.
So if you owned it, were you just shit out of luck?
I think you could actually apply for 500 points somewhere.
Oh, okay.
to compensate you because basically, you know, it wasn't up to snuff. I mean, it's a simple fact. But what that shows you is that all the hundreds of other games across all the other regions, nothing like this has ever happened. And of course, this is why it can't happen, because you end up getting into this kind of awkward situation, having to, you know, give people credit and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just, you know, nothing anyone wants to get into on a mass scale. And so if that's where the bar is, then, you know, I don't know to what extent that imposes costs to put people off in certain areas in terms of doing, you know, what is being done with the Sunsoft stuff, perhaps with other portfolios from the past.
Yeah, I mean, it very well be that Nintendo just looked at it and said, look, we aren't making, like, Sunsoft may make a little bit of money, but it's likely that Nintendo is like, if we're not making a lot of money on these releases, then let's not even bother.
Well, and I think there's also a lot of least resistance of emulation. So I don't know if you guys remember, but when Xbox 360 first came out, one of the big things that it did was backwards compatibility with Xbox games. Mm-hmm. And the way they did this was all software emulation.
Right.
And what they would do is they would focus on making the emulator work for a big game like Halo. And in the process of doing that, they would then have some poor soul whose job it was to check every other Xbox game to see if it would work with the version of the emulator that they made specifically for Halo. And so what they would do is every few months they'd release like a new version, a new update for the software, and it would be like, now you can play Halo and also Barbie Horse Adventure. And a bunch of other...
Yes, because I remember there was a bunch of big games that still weren't compatible, and then there was some bullshit, and it might have been Barbie Horse Adventure, some bullshit.
There's all kinds of stuff. Yeah, it was just stuff that just got carried along for the ride.
And basically, like, the whole internet went up in arms, like, they made that game compatible, but Halo 2 doesn't work?
Yeah, they didn't understand the process. But yeah, there are still a number of original Xbox games that don't work on 360 because...
They just gave up.
And Microsoft came out and said, look, we did the ones we could. There are certain ones that we could probably make them work if we spent a ton of time on it, but it's not worth it because there aren't that many people who care.
Well,
so fuck
and
you.
It's
and that's basically what Nintendo's saying, except Nintendo won't actually come out and say that publicly, whereas Microsoft at least was up front about
also,
it.
But also, I mean, these are downloads that they're charging for. I mean, it's different, but I suppose...
It's a business case more, yeah.
Yeah, the question we're faced with now, in light of what happened at E3, where they showed the little demo with the old games running on 3DS, with the 3D effect applied to them in some way, is could they be preparing a kind of not just a portable, you know, old portable games kind of service for 3DS, but also games we already have on Virtual Console or games we don't already have, and we're going to kind of bleed off Virtual Console and then hopefully get some sort of pent-up demand that's going to help launch this new service where maybe they're going to go more of a premium because it's ostensibly enhanced.
Yeah.
With some sort of 3D display.
That's what I'm thinking. They might resell them in 3D.
No. That's not a Nintendo works. Nintendo would have sold them and continued to be selling them right up until the point that 3DS comes out, and then the Valve gets shut off completely.
Well, they're selling them, but then what I'm saying is in terms of things like certain titles, like, you know, a Yoshi's Island or something, do they feel now that it would be better just to hold that off?
Well, Yoshi's Island was running on 3DS.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that was there, and it's one of the biggest omissions.
I feel like their personal desire would be more to sell you the game on the Wii and then sell it to you again on 3DS.
That may be the case, yes.
Well, I think that certainly if they do that on 3DS, I mean, it'll be on Wii, but I guess the question I'm asking is, could they just hold off a couple of titles just to give it a bit of a bump, rather than just literally, these are all the games you've already bought?
Yeah.
Twice now, actually. You bought them on the N64 and on the Wii, and now you can buy them again on 3DS.
Triple dip, baby.
I think the interesting part of that is that I can imagine that there may be some kind of algorithm that they've got that could actually, like, batch process these old ROMs for 3D so that you don't have to reprogram them meticulously one at a time. Because especially with systems like NES and Super NES, the way the graphics run on those systems is they kind of run on layers, you know? So you have a tile layer, which is, you know, on NES is usually like your level, and then you have a sprite layer, which is usually your character that's basically superimposed on top of that. So all you have to do for 3DS is just have an algorithm that tells the 3DS to separate those layers in the ROM. So you might not have to reprogram game by game, which means and this is all very speculative, but if they have this working, it's possible that they might be able to give you access to the virtual console games that you've already bought and just run them in 3D on the 3DS and not have to repurchase them or reprogram them all separately.
Well, I certainly could see the not having to reprogram part in terms of having to repurchase.
The only issue with that, though, is somebody's going to need to go back through, because if you go through and turn off layers on some of those games, you'll see that they didn't quite use them like you would expect them to. Like, they just did crazy shit with layers.
Yeah, certain games played a lot of tricks with it, and those probably wouldn't be supported.
I think they would have to go through and test all those games anyway.
As it is with virtual console games, each game has its own specific version of the emulator and everything. I mean, there's always these tunings that seem to be made.
Right.
Yeah, the Star Fox 64 incident where they retuned it, yes.
Yeah, they had to retune afterwards.
But what I'm saying is, I think the 3D effect could be run in kind of a shell, and then you load the ROM into that, which is a big difference from porting the game to 3DS, which means going into the original code and adding a bunch of new shit, you know, and that is extremely difficult.
To me, what it would be like is to 3D what the Super Game Boy did in terms of color.
Exactly. And it won't look great on every game, but it will be technically in 3D.
Yeah, as I say, it would be ostensibly enhanced. There's some sort of pretense of value added, which perhaps with some exclusive titles to get it off and running, and of course you could well go into the portable back catalog as well to help sort of pad that out. Maybe that is where they're kind of going with it, and so that may help explain some of the continuing indifference towards Wii, because they're kind of preparing a kind of relaunch of the whole idea, perhaps, for 3DS.
So wait and see.
Yep.
Andrew had a sub question about the demo service, which was actually for WiiWare, not Virtual Console. But in terms of what happened to the demo service, fuck if we know.
No idea. That was one of the weirdest sort of, you know, dipping your toe in the water situations, wasn't it? It was so specific.
And by all accounts, it was really successful.
Yeah.
I know Alex Noisy said that they were very happy with the sales of BitTrip Beat once that demo went up. And that game had already been out for 6 months, so...
And probably done relatively well, as it was, because there was actually, you know, good, solid word of mouth for that game.
Yeah, it had already sold to a lot of people who were going to buy it, and then they put the demo out, and a lot more people bought it who previously would not have. They were very pleased with it, and I think he's been on the record as saying that he wishes they would bring it back, and he has no idea why they took them down and why they aren't doing any new demos. It beats all, man. Beats all I've ever seen.
It would almost make more sense if they'd never done it. You know, if it was just categorical, we don't do demos, that's not anything we have ever believed in, rather than this sort of flirtation and then nothing.
The only thing I can come up with is that it wasn't looking out for number one. Like they looked at themselves and said, this really isn't worth our time. It may be worth the time of the developers who are putting it out there.
But yeah, it's not, like everybody wants our games, so it doesn't really matter.
Could you not make that determination without doing this minor experiment?
Well, no, because you could do the experiment and see, all right, well, let's determine what our cut of this game is going to be and see if maybe it makes enough for us to deal with all this stuff.
Yeah.
Nintendo itself has very few WiiWare games. And they're not really among the best titles.
They're usually like your Pokemon management suite.
Yeah. They're not really among the best stuff. So maybe it's just one of those cases where Nintendo themselves have very little impetus to bother with it. So they don't really care if all the third parties want it.
Well, they're not invested. I mean, that's again, goes to this indifference issue.
Yeah, so, I mean, their really only money-making avenue for this is basically their cut of WiiWare sales. Maybe the experiment was, all right, well, let's see how much of a bump it generates and extrapolate how much money we could assume to make from these demos.
I wonder if they've made more from selling development kits to WiiWare developers than they have royalties.
I guarantee you some games they made more money selling the kit than the royalties.
For sure. Absolutely.
For all those freaking games that no puts out on the DSi for My Notebook Pearl, my Notebook Slate, and My Notebook Uranium Edition. I mean,
Carbon.
I think those notebooks actually done disturbingly well.
Okay, well, James, you have the next email.
So Alex from Massachusetts writes, with games like Kid Icarus over the horizon, it appears that previously short-lived franchises are being given new life. If you were given one classic Nintendo game to remake, and parenthetically notes, preferably out of the Game & Watch series...
No.
And...
Not in the bowl. You're not interested in seeing the bowl reborn.
Fire.
Oh. And had to remake it as a full-featured and full-priced Nintendo console game. What game would you remake, and how would you do it?
Devil World.
Pac-Man clone Reaper.
I think there's a Game & Watch series that some people might have heard of. I think they could really make a good console game out of this Game & Watch game called, like, Zelda or whatever it's called.
Oh, yeah.
They made some console games
donkey
out of
something?
That.
Think, yeah, there was a Donkey King.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one NES game I haven't even played, actually, but what I'm kind of interested in, I might have to eventually get it on Virtual Console Play because I've heard good things about it, is Wrecking Crew.
Mm.
Is this viable in any sense for some sort of...
Make it like a Red Faction Guerrilla kind of thing.
I think a Wrecking Crew RPG is where you're going with this. You need to level up your hammer.
I've never played Wrecking Crew either. I always kind of was curious about it myself.
If you've seen what Wrecking Crew is, you've seen what Wrecking Crew is.
Yeah, it's one of those like extremely early NES games where it's almost like Ice Climber is so simple. I can't imagine paying like 50. It's like an Atari 2600 game.
Yeah,
well, it's single screen arcade games basically.
That's what a lot of the Game & Watch games are too, though. I mean,
yeah, it's hard to imagine doing like a modern version of that would be satisfying to play.
Yeah, I mean, it's like with Kid Icarus itself. I mean, what you've got some sort of Sin and Punishment ish kind of game.
They basically said, all right, what game can we rip off?
Apply to the old original Kid Icarus. I mean, the direct sort of link between those two game types is not obvious, is it?
Clue Land?
Rad Racer, maybe? I mean, if you could count that as a Nintendo game?
That's Square.
Yeah. Were they Mach Rider?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Nintendo made Mach Rider.
I guess. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean...
I'm going to go with Pikmin. It'd be cool if they made a new one of those.
Because
F-Zero, Pikmin,
allegedly, they're making other Pikmin, so... What about... Oh, what was that Game Boy game? It was like Naval Combat.
Oh, Steel Diver?
No. Good game. Radar Mission? Yeah, that's it. Like, I actually remember that game, but I don't remember if I enjoyed that game. I just remember having that game. that's basically the end of that conversation.
Do you remember Stunt Racer FX?
Yep.
Yeah.
That was a Miyamoto-produced game. Maybe directed it, I'm not sure.
I mean, I guess they could make a platformer out of Lolo. I mean, that's a HAL game.
Yeah, actually, Lolo would be great on DS. That's a great choice, James. I love Lolo.
I mean, I'm kind of struggling to think of the franchises they forgot because they freaking forgot them.
Everyone wants Duck Hunt. That's begging for a full price reimagining.
I don't know about that, but I'd love a WiiWare Duck Hunt.
Yeah, I mean, most of these, the most obvious thing to think of when you're talking about going back this far to something that was one-off in the 8-bit or 16-bit era is kind of what they did with Excite Bike or World Rally,
yeah.
Whatever it was, WiiWare kind of upgraded.
Yeah, but that's a bit too slavish, I think, to the
well,
original.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying it's easy enough to imagine something like that. Whereas projecting all the way forward to what is being asked in this question about a full price game is significantly more tricky.
Right. I mean, they did it with Punch Out and did a great job with it.
Yeah, give them credit for that, definitely. But I think Punch Out's sort of particularly robust play mechanic. It holds up relatively a lot better than a lot of games from that era if you just go back and play the NES one.
We could always bring back Odama. I think that's
Odama.
I think that absolutely needs to incorporate more devices.
We have to name drop Odama at least once every couple of months.
10-yard fight? Come on. Everybody wants to do 10-yard fight.
We're scratching the bottom of the barrel here.
Well, I mean, there is one that's kind of happened. I've talked about it on the show before. There's that the game that's a bit like Zelda, but it's ancient Japan themed. And
right.
Nozo no Murasamajo. That,
yes.
That has like a mode in Samurai Warriors 3 or whatever.
Is it official though, or is it kind
yeah,
of?
Yeah,
like
well,
like
no,
a...
because that one, at least in Europe, that game was published by Nintendo.
Yeah, but Capcom made that game. So I think it's actually more of a tribute.
Okay, so Samurai Warriors is Tecmo Koei, And Sengoku Basara is Capcom.
Yeah, that's the one, the Tecmo one. It has the Nintendo mode.
Yeah,
in
so Sengoku Basara is a Capcom jobbing Koei's franchise.
So what is that one called? Samurai.
Sengoku Basara is actually the name of the game in the West too.
Really? Clearly, I had these games confused in my mind.
No, they're almost identical. I played both of them in E3. They're almost identical. I played one and then went to the other, and I'm like, holy crap, Capcom should be sued for this game.
And then you played it on 3DS, and it's the same on there, too.
I was like, how has Capcom not been stopped from making this game?
There's one of the only differences I can think of is that it has this mode inspired by a Famicom game in it, in the case of the Tecmo/Nintendo one.
I remember last year I was on the Combo Breaker podcast, which I don't think is around anymore. I don't think they've updated in a while. But one of the guys said that one of his most anticipated Wii games was Samurai Warriors 3. And I was like, really? You on crack.
Yeah.
Think harder. Try again.
I would kind of like to play that game, but my most anticipated.
One that doesn't get much mention is, and I know Greg will appreciate this, but the Yoshi platformers.
Yeah.
Have really been pretty much abandoned by Nintendo. So there's Yoshi's Island 2 for DS, but that was made by R-Toon.
And the weird thing about that is it was a massive success in Japan, retail-wise, for what must have been a pretty paltry budget of a game.
Yeah.
It sold nearly as many copies as Mario Galaxy did in Japan. Nearly a million units. It was like something in the top 15 selling games for the calendar year 2007.
And you have to wonder if that makes Nintendo think about, maybe we should make a new one of these ourselves. You know, Yoshi went through a long lull after Yoshi's Story on N64. The next one we had was like, I think Yoshi Topsy Turvy for GBA, and then you had Yoshi Touch and Go, but two gimmick games, basically.
Yeah, especially Touch and Go is like a spin-off. I mean, it's Metroid Prime Pinball for Yoshi, basically.
I just think a new Yoshi platformer made by Nintendo would be pretty cool. That'd be great, like for EAD Tokyo, be a cool follow-up project for
the
them.
The pointer, it's begging
yeah,
for
the pointer.
It.
Yep. I mean, personally, I'd be happy with a new Gumshoe, Gyromite, Hogan's Alley, or Ice Hockey, but that's just me. That's just me.
It took John 15 minutes to get to Wikipedia.
Yes, he has.
Maybe a new Kung Fu, maybe an NES open tournament call. Forget it. Forget it. Oh, hold on. The article cuts off. Wait a minute. Hold on.
Clue Land. Bring it. Clue Land. I want it.
Hogan's Alley.
Pro wrestling? Nice.
Oh, God.
Pogue Squadron writes, I know that some of you guys love sports games, notably football games, and some of you guys aren't huge sports guys. Now,
start looking it up, John.
Now, I don't think you are the biggest baseball fans, but I really have to ask someone this. How is it that in the almost 4 years of the Wii's existence, there has not been one good baseball game? How on earth is it that the best baseball game is the Home Run Derby in Wii Sports? Is it really that hard? Is it just another release that you think would be a no-brainer and would sell millions to the casual and core gamer markets? Baseball always seemed like a sport to me that would work best on the Wii. I would love to see a baseball game on the Wii that is baseball's equivalent to the Tiger Woods games. What are your thoughts?
I think I am qualified to answer this question.
I know a little about it, but yes, you are the most qualified.
It's a miserable path of sadness that I'm about to unleash on poor Poke Squadron.
Dear.
So the reason why there's not a Tiger Woods equivalent for baseball on the Wii is that
EA's not allowed.
Right. So 2K has the exclusive baseball rights with the exception of Sony's self-published stuff.
Well, actually, just to be clear, all of the platform holders are allowed to make their own first-party MLB games.
Okay.
But Sony's the only one that bothers.
Right. I'll get to why people don't do that in a minute. But the reality is 2K doesn't have a great track record of caring on Wii ports. And then they basically aren't concerned with it. It's not their big money maker. So they concentrate on making the most realistic game they can for their baseball franchise on the HD consoles. And if you look at, and I didn't go into it why I bought the 360 version, because Johnny asked why I didn't buy the Wii version. And all you have to do is look at the back of the box for the Wii game and then compare it to the back of the box of the 360 game, and it looks like it's more than one hardware generation apart.
Ooh.
The Wii game looks pretty ugly.
And it probably doesn't have like the cool batting controls from Wii Sports, which I love. That's one of my favorite things in Wii Sports is the batting.
And that's my secondary point, which is it would be very hard to make a realistic batting game there, because in the 360 version of this game, how you drive the ball is controlled both by the left analog stick and giving direction and how much force you want to put in terms of pop-ups and when the timing of your swing. So that would be very hard to map with the Wii Remote, because you'd have to understand when the point of the swing is, where you're crossing over the plate. It would be a very difficult thing to get right, much more so than a golf game, which you're basically thing against the ground. You're not having to map it to the speed of an oncoming object. So I think that the level of difficulty, if you wanted to allow for somebody to really have control over where they want to drive the ball, is more complicated than doing golf. And to be honest, the reason that Nintendo doesn't make its own baseball game, although they did already, and never released it, is in part because in Japan, baseball is wildly popular. In the U.S., I mean, there's a market for it, but that's it. I mean, you have exhausted the market. With Madden, you can get away with it because Madden sells so many damn copies in North America. But you can market NBA games in Europe. You can market them in North America. You can market them to a limited extent in Asia. It's much more difficult to sell a baseball game in Europe.
A lot of them just don't come out.
Yeah. And you go back to football/soccer, and supposed to football/ whatever they call it in Europe.
Just American football or the NFL.
There's a big European market, there's a big Asian market, and you can sell some in North America, and you can sell in Central American regions. So there's markets for all the other sports.
A worldwide sport.
Right. But it's more so in that if you were to develop a really good game for it, you're already developing it for the Wii, for a regional game. Maybe you split your market too much. Whereas golf is actually wildly successful everywhere for some reason, because it's so freaking boring.
But not more boring than baseball.
Oh no, it's way more boring than baseball.
So there is a good baseball game on Wii. It's called Power Pro from Konami. It's not Major League Baseball. It's unlicensed, but it comes from Japan and it has big heads.
Yep.
And there is even an English version available in the US that was released. They haven't released all of them because there's several in Japan. I mean, this Konami series comes out every year for every platform.
Yeah, DS as well.
Yeah, but there is at least 1 year that it came out in North America. And it's pretty good from what I've heard. I don't know that the batting controls are that good. I'm pretty sure you can play it with classic controller even if you want.
Yeah, I mean, do you think there's a fundamental issue in terms of doing like a MLB license or just like a simulation game of having motion controls for the batting in terms of the length of the game and all this kind of stuff? I mean, you know, fatigue. I mean, obviously the Wii Sports baseball is very drastically scaled back.
Yeah, it's only a handful full innings in the Wii Sports one.
And Super Sluggers is the same way, right? It's just very arcadey and short games.
I mean, I've had, just playing 2K, I've had, you know, at-bats last 10, 12 pitches, and it's exhausting, just stressful going through that many pitches.
Yeah, just mentally going through it.
Because you just keep fouling off. If you were to do that with the Wii Remote, you would be in pain.
And also, I mean, you look like, even with Super Sluggers, which obviously is not really kind of the subject of this question because it is so arcadey, however you want to put it.
And it's not that good.
Well, I mean, it got some decent reviews. It's not great. It's very similar to the previous games, and that's the point. It doesn't really advance the motion control scene in the Wii Sports baseball stuff.
It's not even as good as Wii Sports.
It's more gesture-based. It's more like just an analog for what they were doing with the GameCube Mario Baseball.
Right.
So no one's really taken this forward, and I think some of that issue may be because it's just how practical is it really to have people swinging...
Dangerous.
It makes sense as part of a party game, a component of a party game. Now, what's weird to me is that it wasn't reprised in Wii Sports Resort. because you would have thought Motion Plus would add to that quite a bit. And they weren't afraid to reprise other things like golf. So that I thought was particularly inexplicable, even compared with everything else.
So here's where I think Motion Plus would be huge, though. I think in batting it would be a pain in the ass, but I think in pitching it could be really interesting.
Yeah, that could be pretty cool.
Pitching is in how your arm moves. So if they could really map the motion of the Wii Remote in 1-to-1, besides the fact we'd have a whole new rash of destroyed TVs, I think they could actually do a pretty good job of giving you real control over your pitches. Now, what that might do, though, is make the game impossibly difficult.
Well, I mean, you could have that toggleable.
Yeah.
Being able to turn it on and off, right?
Yeah, I mean, being a major leaguer is not easy, obviously, so you wouldn't want to do one-to-one mapping,
I think. Well, I mean, you look at the way Tiger does it with Motion Plus. They have these different range of settings in terms of settings that don't really utilize the Motion Plus, then it kind of goes up to a point where it's like, you know, the highest, like, master setting where it's really putting that strain on you, putting the burden on you to control your movements very precisely because it's reading them very precisely. And I would assume any kind of baseball game that would use a Motion Plus, for example, would have to do a similar thing because, you know, not everyone's going to want that, and certainly not everyone's going to want that straight away. They may want to kind of work up to it.
I am very interested in what becomes of the show and with the move out. Like what the next iteration of the show does with it. Because they have to support it. Because I think if you make a Move game, or if you make a PS3 game in-house now at Sony, you don't support the Move, you'll be executed for not supporting the company mantra.
Yes.
Yeah. So it'll probably have to be in 3D with Move support.
Yeah.
It will cost $6,000, $7,000 to play, plus the cost of a TV.
They'll sell 10 copies.
Oh, yeah. And
but Sony will say it's a roaring success.
It's going to be interesting to see what they do with it. See if they try to use one-to-one mapping or if they just totally blow it off and make it more gesture-based. Because I think they have to get that right because right now they're trying to say, well, look, this is what we can do with our device. If they put out something that's shit in first party, it will not reflect well on them.
I mean, it'd certainly be one of the more compelling, if they could get something that really seemed to work, applications of Move, because a lot of the stuff we've seen so far
or of Motion Plus, for that
is
matter.
Sorting chicks, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the kind of things, in terms of Move specifically, I mean, yeah, Motion Plus is right as well. In terms of Move, a lot of what we're seeing so far is, yeah, very analogous to things we've seen on Wii.
Right.
You know, like RE5 with motion controls, RE4 Wii Edition, Killzone 3, Metroid Prime 3.
Well, I mean, it is a Me Too pun.
Yeah, oh, it is.
It completely is, yeah.
In other words, because there hasn't been a good motion control baseball game on Wii, it's good territory for Sony to go and say, look, we're doing something new.
And they also happen to have this highly acclaimed baseball franchise that they've established as a first party thing. So, I mean, I think the point would be if they don't do anything with it, and you know, if Move and the show don't mesh together, it kind of says that maybe there isn't a good way to do it.
Or it just says that they're not ready to do it themselves. Yeah. I mean, maybe this way, the stuff that we saw at E3 for Move was either a first-person shooter or, as I was referencing earlier, chick-sorting games.
That's it. I mean, it's if you watch, there's a video on the Digital Foundry blog here from Eurogamer, the tech side, where someone just demonstrates like pure tech demo stuff for Move, which is really impressive. It's like, oh, I had no idea it could do some of this stuff.
Right.
They have singularly failed to communicate in the actual games.
Oh, well, that is Sony to a T, to singularly fail at communicating.
Hearing people talk about Move honestly makes me sleepy. It's like the most boring thing ever. But I just want to say before we go that, to me, baseball games are yet another example of where our WiiWare developers are letting us down. Because if you're going to make an unlicensed baseball game with Motion Plus support, motion controls, and really just try to do something experimental with it. You know, if there's clearly a niche here that's not being served, why isn't there something like this on WiiWare? I know Neil Ronahan is screaming for Let's Catch. Let's Catch is not a baseball game, but
isn't there an actual batting practice WiiWare application from Konami? I think there is.
There should be. I mean, there should, you know,
yeah, there should be.
It doesn't even have to be base running. You can make a home run derby WiiWare game with Motion Plus with really good controls, and you could totally make a business case for that existing.
I mean, there's all those very child focused baseball games on Wii or the backyard baseball series.
But oh, I mean, yeah, no.
But I mean, like, that's it.
Sammy Sosa softball.
What was that, steroid softball?
No, there is a Sammy Sosa softball for PS1 or PS2.
Oh.
What about the mini game using the vitality sensor we have to testify to Congress?
Oh, shit. Okay. This episode has jumped the shark. So.
Oh, no. It's gone right where I like it.
That's going to be the end of listener mail. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. Great questions this week. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We love getting these emails. We love reading your letters.
The Clemens joke just made it for me. That's great.
So before we go, I will remind everyone that we are on Facebook. We have over 100 fans now. So my check's in the mail. Pretty excited.
Yeah, where's the other 5,000 of you? Come on.
Right.
Don't be shy.
There are a lot of people who aren't fans yet. Let's put it that way. I am trying to post some stuff on there every 2 or 3 days, like little kind of midweek, like between, if you need a fix of RFN between episodes, this is a good way to do it. Also a good way to interact with us. So we're posting on there. I'm putting up photos and little links to things. So it's a fun little place. You can meet your other fellow listeners and we'll form a community around the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So check that out. Actually, you can now get to it by typing in facebook.com/radiofreenintendo, all one word. I set that up because I'm good at that stuff. We also are listed on iTunes, and you can check us out on iTunes, leave a review, give us a star rating. We would appreciate that. There is a new NWR newscast out, so definitely check that out. I believe it is the first 4-man podcast that they've done. So Nathan seems to be quite the regular on there now. Nathan Graybrick, Nathan Mustafa. And, yep, that's a good episode. You should check that one out. It's a good return to form after the Cricket cast.
Cricket cast. Sorry, delayed reaction,
John,
on that one.
What the frick was that?
Delayed reaction.
Lag.
John's going to laugh about that tomorrow morning. It's going to be like 2 in the afternoon. Cricket cast. Oh,
that's genius. That's genius. Sorry. Sorry. Are we still meeting?
It was genius of a sort.
If I get a phone call from John tomorrow about cricket cast, I'm blocking your phone number.
Before we go, I do want to mention that after the show is over, we will have a short commercial from Carl, our ex-host, Carl Castaneda, about crosstalk.com, which is his website. They're doing all these weird podcasts about beer and movies and other things. Check that out. It's actually, they're all really fun. And I can say, absolutely guaranteed that the new episode of Box Office Poison will be up by the time you hear this. It will have already been out, and I do recommend that you check it out. We had a good time. All ex-RFN people, and me, on there. So they are familiar voices if you've been around for a while, and we talk about movies, and it's a lot of fun. So check that out as well. Just stay tuned and listen to the commercial and be mortified of its content. So, all right, that's it. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you
later.
See ya.
Hey there, folks. Carl Castaneda here, your occasional contributor. I just thought I'd take a moment to give you a heads up about a side project of mine called Crosstalk.com. Unlike my last podcast, with Crosstalk, we're really striving for a classier and more refined image. Take our first series, Rough Draft, the Beer Appreciation Show.
It's me and Casper at the door, and I'm like, look, dude, you can do whatever you want. I'm going back to my door, right across the street. And you think you said, hey, just stay with me, we're just going to hang out for a bit, make sure I don't do anything stupid. What you actually said was, you and me are going to run a train on this girl.
And of course, Box Office Poison, which stars myself along with a full roster of RFN alumni, in addition to current RFN host Johnny Metz.
There's nothing quite like every dump I take every morning, you know? I don't feel like... I have a unique piece of art in my toilet every day.
Every poop is a snowflake.
Finally, we're also rehearsing our favorite episodes of the show that started it all, Talk Board 12.
I went to his gag point. No, okay, like, it's a guilty pleasure because people think I'm like a dick and like some sadistic person for liking this, but I really do. Like, I really like watching girls get their throats like pounded to the point where like there's like saliva, maybe a little vomit on the dick, and like they're crying.
Those are 12 to 18 demographics.
So head on over to crosstalk.com. That's crosstawk.com. Or check us out on the iTunes Music Store. Having said that, let's get back to the show.
So they're now sending me a shipping label to mail these year-old shoes that I've spent the last 10 months in the postal system to them. Just for the hell of it. Because I don't want these fucking shoes. But that has been, hopefully, end of this particular saga, although I doubt it.
That is an odyssey. Wow.
Evil never dies.
I fully expect something bullshitty will happen in the next month.
Well, you know somebody's gonna hear this on the podcast and they're gonna show up at your door and they're gonna be I want my fucking shoes, man. Give me your Xbox too. I'm out of here.
They're the ones that say bad motherfucker on them. James pulls it out of the bag.
Sure enough.
This is yours.
It's so weird. I'm going to write a blog post update for this with pictures of the shoes.
I can't wait for that. James, do you have a video game to talk about this week?
I do. I just felt like the audience needed to hear that.
James's game of life is much more interesting than any video game.
We shall
Greg,
see.
You could just set that to some really bizarro music and it'll be fine.
Get the yakety sax going. I'll have to satisfy myself with the Benny Hill girls to chase around. Unfortunately, that can't be put into podcast form.